Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPR 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I am Al Warren. Co-host today is Mr. John COVID Copenhaver. How are you doing, John?
Hey, Al. I'm doing just fine and recovering nicely. So, you know, yay science.
Yeah, it wasn't that hard on you, was it,
this version? No, it really wasn't. Actually, the biggest pain was staying home. So, really, I can't complain. I know a lot of folks out there have had a lot worse, and so I'm pretty good. Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know, but you were taking bleach all the week, weren't you? Or
oh yeah, it's great. It's great for the you know, the digestive tract. I do not like bleach.
Okay, now we've got another guest that you brought to the show, which is great. You always bring interesting people. We've got the author of Doubting Thomas, and that's Matthew Clark Davison. Thank you for being here, Matthew.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. How do you classify yourself as a writer? Let's start there. Like, what kind of writer are you?
I think of myself primarily as a fiction writer because I'm interested in the truth that comes out of being able to make stuff up. And then from there, probably more of a literary fiction writer. But I also think that that's such a broad category compared to other people that use those terms. Maybe because I work in an MFA program. Our particular program is very open and expansive. And of course, mystery, thrillers, horror, all sorts of, previously stamped on literary genres in our program and in my mind can all be literary if they dig into the stuff that's, you know, the hard to answer questions about what it means to be human.
Well, is that kind of your description of what a literary writer is?
I feel like literary fiction does try to grapple with bigger and unanswerable questions versus, say, a more commercial fiction, which might just want to reinforce things that human beings like to think and feel. Like, we all want to think and feel that the bad guy is going to get punished and the good guy is going to get rewarded. But, and I think that there's, you know, if you were to look at my queue on any of the TV subscriptions that I have, you'd see that those kinds of stories are entertaining and stuff that my brain needs. But when I sit down to write, I'm really attempting to dig into stuff that I don't know. And I think that that's that's the broadest way, like it, that I try to define literary versus commercial fiction. I think that there could be a better way to classify it, but given what's thrown around, I would have to say that my book probably gets, the stuff that I write probably gets classified as literary fiction most often.
So you would consider that you do creative research, you know, like it's something that is from outside of your own personal experiences.
Well, Thomas, the main character in Doubting Thomas, it passes as straight, for example. And once, I think it was in 2001, I was in the corner of a dark bar in a suburb outside of Milan, Italy. And somebody for about 10 seconds mistook me as a straight person. And then I moved 1 centimeter and the illusion was over. So yeah, like I do very much fictionalize, like my characters are not me.
Right.
But I do also write nonfiction and, but in both cases, I'm trying to get to something that I don't know already versus tell you something that I think.
Right. So, because the common nonfiction would be you're identifying a truth or a fact, or you're trying to with the best resources you could. So that's an interesting, there's really kind of a fine line between the two.
Right. And also then what gets to the capital T truth or closer to it, or what is the more compelling examination of the possibilities, what can fall underneath a broader spectrum of truth. And for me, changing details oftentimes, because life, you know, just it's so full of random people and events that don't necessarily in any way, shape or form add to a lot an overall logic. There's so much chaos and there's so much that's random that to be truly married to the idea that I'm going to tell this how it went down limits the possibility of how events and people can be compressed and such in order to get at some bigger truth, I guess I would say.
Yeah. Plus you have to rely on your own memory, which changes constantly, right?
What memory?
Yeah.
I have a cheese block.
Well, it's interesting. So when you set out to write a book like Doubting Thomas, do you have a, let's say a subtext, or do you have sort of a central question and answer you want to display in that book?
I think that every time my process with this novel was that I wrote several different scenes without really knowing where they were going or what they were going to add up to. And I think that eventually, I mean, there was a couple of things that I noticed right away. And one was this question of what, I'm interested in the question of like what our responsibility is to one another. Are we our siblings' keepers? And if we have hurt or have been hurt in our lifetimes, and then we get to a place of relative safety, can we share that safety, or do we as human beings tend to just hoard the safety and try to collect more of it? Because I was a person that had to work pretty hard to keep the blood inside of his body for a particular period of my childhood and adolescence. And then I came to San Francisco during the midst of the worst of the AIDS years. And I felt so under threat for so long that the minute I got kind of a corner of safety, I was screaming on the streets. I was in ACT UP. I was, marching for it. Some of my mentors taught me that, you know, if they're going to come and get me in the morning, they're going to get you at night. So there was no differentiating between the various human rights things that we were all marching for. And I was exhausted by the time I was 25, and certainly by the time I was 30 something. And then I found I was safe and relatively healthy. And, you know, Obama was in office and gay marriage was being legalized in state after state. And I just started to wonder, like, what happens? Like, what is our responsibility to one another when you're in a place of safety in a kind of a greater community that isn't?
And so what's the answer?
I think it's challenging. I think it's a day at a time. And I think that it's challenging. I think I really, really do. I think that there are, you know, of course, if given the opportunity to be useful or helpful or to provide, to give back what so many people, you know, gave me, you know, I want to think of myself as a person who would absolutely do that. But it's also hard to get back out there on the front lines after having spent time on the front line. I don't know. What do you think? What do you both think? I don't know. Can we succeed at being our siblings' keepers beyond the most basic? Or are human beings too selfish for all that?
Well, personally, I think that for the most part, human beings are too selfish, but there will be progress made and there will be some keeping of other siblings, you know, or other people that we are surrounded with in the world. And that's what keeps us moving forward.
Yeah, I think, you know, yes, I mean, I agree with Al. I tend to be a bit of a pessimist, but I do think that people do, you know, do strive forward, do take care of one another, and can be selfless. I think maybe getting more to your point too, like there's a point when you do have to take care of yourself though, and that you, I feels like there's got to be a balance there. And I also think you have to understand the impact you're having, which I think can be the hardest part. Like what is going to have the greatest impact? And I don't think that's always clear in the moment, especially when you're young.
I think that the greatest impact are the things that don't get the attention. You know, unfortunately, the real nice human things to do that we do for each other in subtle ways and in ways that make a real difference aren't really what the focus of the majority of the people are. Most of the people gain attention from doing the wrong thing. And in some cases it brings notoriety, and therefore it's kind of a goal for a lot of humans, a lot of people. So I think it's kind of mixed up. But in the long run, those loud people that do the bad things go away and we forget. But what stays with us is the kind things that happen to us.
I like to think that that's true. But I am also, as an artist, I guess, very fascinated by the fact that, like, you know, in my book, the main character, Thomas, is best friends with he's a fourth grade school teacher, and he's best friends with the principal at his school, at this fancy private school in Portland, Oregon. And they have an incredible friendship. And more than anything, he gets accused of doing something that he doesn't do that leads to his job ending. And more than anything, his best friend, who's the principal, wants to protect him. But she's in a system where protecting him would or attempting to protect him might cause more overall damage than good. And so I'm interested in the very real dilemmas, because, you know, people who have read my book are mad at Mercy, the character who's the principal. Sure. that does that. And, you know, I feel like, you know, what about the hundreds of thousands of kindnesses that she's shown so many people and Thomas prior to being in this near impossible situation, that no matter what she no matter what choice she makes, something's going to be sacrificed. And almost to the point where I wanted to try to portray it in a way that if she would have really, really, really stuck up for him, that she would have lost her job or a significant amount of funding for the scholarship kids, which is the project that she feels most passionately about in her job. So, to me, a person, I don't know. I would like to think that we are capable of also seeing those complexities, but it's hard when personal emotions get involved.
Well, I know that, I mean, it's a huge moral dilemma that Mercy has, because I think in your book, she is sort of also a representative of the school and the liaison to the community. I mean, a lot of it could come unraveled. So, you know, all the same, you know, you, as a reader, you're very angry at her for the choices she makes. That, you know, I'm wondering, like, to what degree, you know, were you thinking about moral dilemmas in this book? It sounds like you were. Do you feel like it's something you've decided on, or something you're still kind of exploring as a writer?
As the book evolved, because I started our conversation today by talking about this idea of, are we our siblings' keepers? And so I'm obsessed with the idea of siblings in general. Like, Thomas is one of three boys, one a queer one, just like me. I'm a middle child. My husband's married. I mean, my husband has two brothers. I was reading Justin Torres's novel, We the Animals, where there's three brothers, and one of them is queer. And I just wanted that novel to keep going, to see how their relationships evolved into their adulthoods. And I think that on some level, I may have started doubting Thomas, because I left home at 15. My older brother was 17, but had been kind of out of the house a lot prior to that. My younger brother was 10. And I went 3,000 miles away from where they lived in Massachusetts to where I ended up in California. And I didn't do a good job of keeping in touch with them for a huge variety of complex reasons. And so the question of, am I a brother? And if so, how, has kind of haunted me for a long time, but I didn't quite have the courage, probably because I was going to have to face certain realities in my own life about my own story, and also how I neglected those relationships based on things that I assumed that they thought and believed without investigating that. So I think I just avoided the topic, even though I was fascinated by it for so long. And when I first started writing Doubting Thomas, I knew that the question of parenthood was going to come up, and that the two straight brothers were dads, and that I knew on some level that things were going to go down. So the question about whether or not Thomas was going to be a parental figure was going to come up. I was writing towards something like that. And then this real life situation happened where a gay teacher in a classroom that I visited along with some other people had touched merely the shoulders of a male child. And somebody who was visiting that same classroom thought that the teacher had touched the kid inappropriately. And this is based on literally, like, a kid got out of line. I thought, at first I was, of course, terrified for the kid, because, you know, you find out a kid wasn't touched inappropriately, and usually kids don't lie about stuff like that. And so I went from that, and then the guy, the administrator who was asking the questions after the witness had said that it was inappropriate, asked really incredible questions. And it turned out, I thought maybe I had missed something, because visiting the same classroom. And then it turned out that the guy just thought that, he said, well, the guy was really flamboyant, meaning very obviously gay, and he was touching the kid's shoulders. And I was just, then I became incredibly worried for the teacher. And for that, my own brother, it's sort of a complex story, but it's like, the, to make it as simple as possible, I had diagnosed the younger brother in the book with a fatal form of cancer prior to my real life younger brother getting diagnosed with a fatal form of cancer. And so when my younger brother in real life was diagnosed with this cancer that he ended up surviving, because he was actually technically misdiagnosed in the beginning, I couldn't write about that anymore. It was too close to home. What started as fiction turned into real life, and then I couldn't keep with the fiction. And so I focused on this other part, which is the accusation in the book, based on this other real life thing. And somehow those two things merged in my head, and I became equally sort of obsessed with the idea of like literal brotherhood, and also this idea of, can we be each other's, you know, can we be our brother's keepers?
Watch it.
Did I just answer a question, or did I just talk for like 9 minutes?
Well, no, I thought that was interesting. I just wonder how you got from one place to the other, because when you get to, I understand the cancer and your own family member, but I'm thinking the accusation into brother's keeper.
I don't know. I was just writing, and I think I was like seeped pretty deeply into Thomas's head. And he was a teacher. But I think that like a lot of the scenes with the brothers had taken place in my notebook without much like ambition or direction. They were just kind of scenes that I was writing, maybe. The first line of the book for a really long time was that he didn't do it. And I know that for mystery writers or whatever, that might be a horrible, and for a long time, it was also the entire first chapter. But I wanted the reader to be very, very clear that the questions that the novel was raising weren't like whether or not he had inappropriately touched the child, but the dilemmas that ensue for being perceived as someone that could have.
Yeah, it feels much more like a novel about impact, you know, than it does a novel about, did he or didn't he? You know, it's not that novel. It struck me as very much about kind of the trauma of being falsely accused and ripple effect that it has on.
Can I jump in and say I see it more as the idea of being accused merely for the fact of someone's impression of what a gay man is.
Yeah.
Right. And I was interested in that more from a very liberal, kind of a neoliberal standpoint. And I think that part of what fueled that was just having lived through Reagan and the Bush years as an out queer person, and the impact that AIDS had on my life, and the way that the government did or did not respond to that, what I call my first pandemic, how it is that you're perceived by the enemy, but how it is that you might be thinking that you're not being perceived that way by people that you consider to be your own community.
How do you get in the heads of people like that do that? I mean, in the fact that you have to be, I would imagine, researching people that are involved in that sort of situation in order to get the characters to sound real.
Well, you know, there's no shortage of in my part of town where I live, there's no shortage of people who see themselves as being very liberal. And I wasn't trying to shine the light on any kind of hypocritical, no, I don't have any interesting commentary on neoliberalism. I was more interested in how we all, including me, at center perhaps myself, want to believe that things are aligned in a way that suit me. And how, when push comes to shove, those things can change very, very quickly. And so I was less trying to get in the head of like a neoliberal. There were some fun little lines that I wrote, especially like in Portland, there's a mom at Thomas's school that has like number one mom as her personalized license plate, and she barely interacts with her own daughter. And you know, texts Thomas as if, you know, she's learned some what she perceives as like kind of gay vernacular from TV or Will and Grace or whatever, and texts phrases to Thomas in ways that are that are intimate in a way that she hasn't earned. And she and others assume that he's much more comfortable with those things than he might be, without really getting to know them. Like, nobody asks him, like, you know, are you cool with this? And also, you know, I spent a lot of time in Portland, and one time I was at New Seasons, which is a grocery store, and I was looking for pine nuts because I was going to make pesto or something. And I was struggling to find them in the nuts section. And this employee of the store, I said, I'm not sure with, first of all, I mispronounced their name. Even though it was like S-I-N-D-Y on the name tag. And I said, Cindy, could you please tell me where the pine nuts were at? And they're like, it's Cindy. And there was no like accent mark or indicator or whatever. And sure, I don't mind being corrected, but it was as if I should have known that in advance. And then they
tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations. Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So we're very pointed in teaching me about my own ignorance, because pine nuts are actually seeds. So they would be in the seed section, not in the nut section. Just like, you know, I had fun, you know, with these very kind of Portlandia moments here and there, but mostly I was incredibly dedicated to seeing myself in the characters that had dilemmas about whether or not Thomas should continue in the classroom with their kids. If that makes any sense. Like, I didn't really have to go out there and research neoliberal hypocrites. I had to look at myself and to see how I contradict myself, how my values may not always align with my actions.
What was the significance of Portland? Like, why there?
I was there with my husband. My husband's like one of the characters in the book, Manny. He's mixed race. He identifies Black. His dad was born in Sierra Leone and his mom was German. And we were walking through my friend's neighborhood during the Obama years. And Ansu said, my husband said, you know, wow, I've never seen so many Black Lives Matter signs and so few Black people. And also, I was going there a lot for practical reasons. My friend was having some family issues where she needed, and because I'm a teacher and I have like winter breaks and summer breaks and stuff, I was able to help out a little bit. And so I was there a lot and I just, you know, could write it off. And I also saw, like the school in the book is not a commentary on any real life place. But the physical layout of it is based on a place in real life. And I saw that school and I actually kind of couldn't believe, because I visited schools through a job that I had for many years at a nonprofit in San Francisco. And then I visited this school in Portland and I just couldn't believe the difference between what some children, the environment some children get to learn in versus others. And that stark contrast just made me feel like I would be an idiot not to use that as the setting.
At the end of the book, what is it you want or hope that the reader takes away?
I hope that the reader takes away maybe they don't take away anything. Al, but maybe what they do instead is ask themselves some questions about how they're showing up in their communities and how they're showing up in their families. I don't know. I don't know if I just a good recipe. I kind of thought there's a lot of food in my book and I kind of thought if you hate the book, there should be some good recipes. How to make a pasta with cherry tomatoes. I don't know if I have a particular thing. But there is something that I discovered in the writing of the book about authenticity. Because I'm so unlike Thomas, I sort of thought at one point, like, is this just a vanity project? Am I just like punishing this guy because he passes his straight and avoided the AIDS years that I had to live through in San Francisco? And he took off to Portland during the worst of the loss in San Francisco in the community. And he sort of allowed the fact that like he had to tell people that he was gay to shelter him from, you know, he sort of gleaned all of the rights that the out gay folks were fighting for without doing much of the work. And at one point I was just like, you know, because Thomas has a really, really, really bad year. And I just thought, am I punishing a character for being all of the things that I'm not? And I realized, no, you know what? I'm asking myself the question, you know, where am I hiding and where am I being authentic, I think. Yeah. So,
you know, one thing that I, you know, it's sort of interesting as you're talking, I'm thinking about the story a bit and about, you know, I mean, from your standpoint, of course, you're exploring this character and thinking about it, as we fiction writers often do. We're trying to sort of pull parts of ourselves out and put them into characters to essentially explore something about ourselves. But, you know, as a reader, I kept on thinking about it as a story of a community. And there's this moment, and I'm going to misquote it, but Thomas's lawyer sort of is making a comment about, you know, the fact that this community, I guess sort of neoliberal community, they kind of want a villain and he's it, you know? They actually want him to be guilty, which is struck me as a very weird thing to want. We actually want to believe that there was a pedophile in our midst, opposed to, oh, we were wrong, you know, our children are safe and, you know, things are all right, which is what you would think they would want, right? And I thought that was such an interesting insight, and maybe I connected with it at least. And I wondered if you thought about sort of why that might be the case, what that's saying about communities. Is that just do you think that's just a neoliberal thing, or is that kind of like a human thing? I don't know. What do you think?
I love that question because it's one of the parts of the novel that I think is most surprising for me to discover, like the idea of Thomas as a pariah and the country day community needing or wanting one was something that surprised me. I do feel like it's an homage in a way and I didn't know this on purpose when I was writing it, but I think that in hearing you describe it, I thought of Sula, the novel by Toni Morrison, and in how when she returns to the bottom in the second half of the novel after she leaves, she shares these insights that she has. I mean, they kind of come out in her conversations with Nell about how, or maybe it's the narrator. I need to reread it again, but maybe it's the omniscient narrator. But this idea that a community needs a pariah in order to believe in its own wellness, in order to not reflect on the probable chance that there is no pariah and there is no hero and there's no one that's pure. We're all probably in varying degrees a combination of all of those things.
You know the story by Ursula Le Guin called The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. I think that's how you say it. It's very short, but it's all about a community it's a perfect ideal utopia, except that there's a child that they keep in the basement in one of the houses that gets beaten and tortured. The rest of the community is perfect, but only because they have this child. So it's sort of a moral dilemma. Is that okay or not okay? Clearly it does not sound okay, but you know, it's interesting. It does seem to be something that is something like a core human thing, which I think went past just about a commentary on a particular community of people or that outlooks and seem to be more about like human nature, you know, which is chilling. maybe true.
Well, but if it is, and I'm so glad that you read the book as a book about community, because my own family is multiracial, like the cast of characters in the book, and we are forced to deal with, we love each other and we want each other to be well, but we all have very different experiences, and so we have to confront some really tough sometimes about that. I think that some people have the luxury to ignore, and you know, we do live in a culture that is riddled, unfortunately, with racism and misogyny and homophobia and other things. And you know, if one or more of those things don't affect you, and you're busy dealing with all of the other stuff that does and all your trials and tribulations, then it's difficult to kind of validate and do the work so that you can see that these things are actually affecting the people that you love. You may not be able to do anything about it, but you also don't need to necessarily deny it. I don't know. I feel like Chad in the book, the kid that gets so ruthlessly fag bashed in that Const Thomas in his memory was one of the pariahs at that school. And Thomas benefited from him being the pariah because his gayness was so overt that compared to Thomas didn't have to suffer. So, I mean, he had to, you know, conceal parts of himself, but I don't really, that doesn't make me, do you know what I mean? That's harder to empathize with as a mode of suffering. It certainly is, than somebody whose life is being endangered by the treatment that they're getting because of how they're perceived. Do you know what I mean? There are varying degrees of suffering.
I think that, I mean, that idea of, which I think does work throughout the book a great deal, of, you know, what it means to be, you know, out essentially from the beginning and then to sort of pass for a while, and the safety in that, going back to your theme of safety, you know, it is something that certainly connected with me. I was definitely kind of a Thomas, and I definitely knew a Chad. And so it's, you know, and it does have an impact, but it also, the shame of that is complex too, you know? So I thought you captured that really well too. It's like there's a shame in not being out as well, which causes a kind of, you know, a resonance or I don't want to call it trauma, but a complexity, emotional complexity to it. You know, I'm thinking about how, so I want to talk a little bit about like your, like, process a little bit, because I know you're a teacher too, and how you know you've talked a lot about sort of, I guess in general terms, maybe how the novel came to be, but was it like an idea that you had, you know, kind of its core initially, or was it really more of a collage or a slow development of ideas?
It was way more the latter. Yeah, I think that just because I live in the Bay Area, and I, you know, as lecturer faculty at a university, I had to work a lot of jobs. And so for me, I also identify as much as a teacher as I do a writer. I know that there's some writers that don't, and some writers who teach that don't, they would like to be a full-time writer, but I love teaching. And I love the fact that I, a high school dropout with, you know, whose parents didn't get a chance to go to college, ended up going to a university and then teaching. What I think is funny and wonderful. And I think that there are, you know, a few students where I teach who relate to that. And so therefore I can kind of be useful in certain ways. But I think that because of those realities, I kind of get to the notebook. And in this case, it really was a notebook with a pen. When something just stirs me emotionally. And I think that, you know, the way in which my brother is both having children and then followed by my younger brother's cancer, which I already said he had survived, thrust me back into the center of my own family in a way that might be similar to how Thomas's accusation thrusts him back into the middle of his family in a much more intimate way. And I had to confront all sorts of things about that myself. And I used fiction, I guess, in order to unravel some of the complexities of that. And so I was just writing scene after scene after scene. Plus, I was processing my own fear around the pendulum swinging the other way. By the way, I want you both to know, I'm fun, and doubting Thomas is funny, but I feel like I'm coming across as so serious in this interview, because some of the subject matters in my book are pretty serious, I guess. But, like, you know, there's also jokes, right, John?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, yeah. Seriousness can't survive without some humor weaved in, I think.
Yeah, and my brothers are wonderful. Their spouses are incredible. I love being an uncle. And, you know, also I've been married, and I got married for very practical reasons at first. But, so I think that to answer your question, it was just a hodgepodge. It was like always centering around this one, particular character. And then when the accusation came in, I think that I had an opportunity to also take a closer look at some of the ways in which I felt like some liberal communities that I belong to engaged in simplistic thinking. And again, I'm never like, I just don't think that I'm the person that's here on earth to call anybody else out, but I am curious about my own behavior. That was the process of this book, was very, very, very much a hodgepodge. And at a certain point, I just started putting together all of the scenes and then eliminating the ones that really were just repeating the same emotional place. And then also I started putting them into chronological order and seeing that there was a bit of a actual plot a kind of question that could get me to the beginning to end. And so I started revising with those things in mind.
By the end of the book, And when you finished that, the whole process of this book and got it published, when you look back at this process, what do you think you learned about yourself?
Well, as a writer, I think I want, one of the things that I would, that I think is very important for me to say is that, you know, this is not the first novel I've ever written. And I do think that the things that I have written in the past haven't necessarily coincided with the things that the big five publishers are, publishing in droves. And so I think that the biggest accomplishment of my life with this book, I mean, of my life, is that I didn't need a book in order to feel validated as a human being or as an artist or as a teacher of creative writing. Because that was hard. There's a lot of pressure in a lot of different ways. And as far as like what I learned from the actual process of writing this book is, other than like, you know, wow, I really can stick with something. I can really try. I really am determined to, you know, I wrote this book because I needed to, but I think that, a deep and compelling love for my brothers that is very complicated by the aspects of our culture that continue on, and, you know, also attempting to try to be the person that I am in relationship to other people versus adjusting my behavior to account for how society might make us feel that we can't be intimate with one another. I think, you know, queer people are constantly being sort of asked to tone themselves down in certain ways. And I know that I have done that. You know, I have committed sins against my own ethics and morals just in what I've worn to my brother's weddings. It is against my morals to wear a regular, like, baggy pair of khakis. Like, that does not gel with my worldview. And yet I've done it in order to be acceptable to feel like I might not get judged. Stuff like that. I just feel like there's very low payoff for pretending to be something that you're not. And then also on the flip side of that same coin, I just at a certain age felt like I no longer need to, you know, show up wearing the things that I might when going out on a Saturday night to the wedding in order to prove a point, that authenticity is something, you know, and true intimacy in relationships is something other than those things that we do that we think are going to, you know, please or challenge each other. Does that even make sense?
Yeah. So you're showing up to your brother's wedding in a G-string.
G-string, but with beaded.
Come on, classy.
I'm not going to just wear the off the rack.
It's going to be couture. Of course. It's got to have a label to it.
No, I mean, I think this is true. I think it goes, I mean, you know, goes both ways too. I feel like, you know, we're either as gay men asked to, you know, come off or hide that by appearing straight in our choice of, you know, how we present ourselves, or we have to like, or there's something wrong with us because we're not like wearing the sequin G-string or the, you know, feather boa, whatever. Like, there's no in between. You're either this or that. You're not sort of something more complex or various, which I think is kind of dehumanizing. And it feels like that's kind of what I'm hearing a little bit, you know, that we should be able to fit all those things together, not have them be absolute, you know, opposites or something. I'm not sure if I'm expressing that very well, but
you are. And I think that beyond myself as an individual, I also feel like I need to give that permission to everyone. It's just like, what are my expectations of other people? Yeah. I see people with RuPaul's Drag Race being so popular and stuff. I see people that are mad because popular culture is appropriating things that started in the gay community. And I get that when like people aren't giving credit to the people that you know, work so hard and also had to pay prices. But when with things that are a little bit like when it's just something like if I associate, say, wearing a bandana around my forehead as gay, and I see a straight person wearing a bandana, somebody that I perceive as straight wearing a bandana around their head, like, do I get to tell that person that they shouldn't be able to do that? I'm not trying to weigh in on whether or not somebody else should engage in that argument. I'm trying to be like a little bit more live and let live for myself and for everyone.
Oh, of course. Let's talk about how people can get a hold of you. How do you like to interact with listeners and readers and fans of yours and stuff? Do you social media, website? Where do people go?
Yeah, my last name has one D in it. It's the very first letter. And so it's Davison. And all of my social media can be found by Googling or whatever, Matthew Clark Davison. I do have a website with a contact information. And, you know, Doubting Thomas is sold everywhere books are sold. So I probably post the most on Instagram, because it's easy. You could just put a picture up there.
How was the writing process over this last few years? You must have been writing through a lot of the mess going on in the world. Did that make it even more intense?
Something about this pandemic, where I got to be quiet and not in the highest risk group, enabled me to access parts of myself that were really, really long buried. And also I found out that I'm a bit more of an introvert than I thought. And so I was very, very, very productive. I have a textbook coming out, co-written with my friend Alice LaPlante with Norton, based on just stuff that I probably would have never been able to do had I been living my regular life. I think things had to really come to a halt for me to prioritize my own writing and my own projects in that particular way. And then I have another nonfiction project happening. And I have actually, I don't think that the world has gotten any worse. I just feel like things may have been, I don't know. I think that maybe things have come more to the surface. So I don't know if all of the struggles that we've had in the variety of ways that we've had have done anything compelling to my, I'll let you be the judge of that someday, but I will say that I have managed to write.
Yeah, you know, I know what you're saying. We see things more, perhaps more clearly now. In the last few years about the struggles and stuff, but having that sort of tension and stress and things like that, that you're sort of outside of your door, so to speak. Do you think you get more, does it seep into your writing, do you think?
Yes. Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Really interesting. The whole world is interesting, you know, but anyway. Well, so for the listeners, we need you to go out and buy a book. It's called Doubting Thomas, a novel. And it's written by our guest, Matthew Clark Davison. And, you know, help him out. He needs a latte. Matthew, thank you for coming on the show.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you for your wonderful questions and for all that you do.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino movie reviews.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.